Hi, welcome to the Friedberg Fourth Quarter Conference Call. I'm David Rothberg. Thank you very much for joining us. With me today is CIO and Chief Portfolio Manager of the Friedberg Asset Allocation Fund and Friedberg Global Macro Fund, Al Friedberg. Good afternoon, Albert.
Hi, David. How you doing?
Good, thank you. So a little bit of housekeeping. We try and keep the call to about 45 minutes. I'm acting essentially as an interlocutor for questions that have been put to me and to Friedberg representatives. If after the call you have further questions, please don't hesitate to update your questions or ask further questions. And without further ado, I'm going to get right to it with Albert. I'm going to bundle a couple of the questions into one, and I'm sure that this is going to wind you up. It seems that the single largest category of gain for the fund in 2020 were stock indices. They showed a 27% gain for the year, according to your recently published Q4 report. Here are a couple of questions. Which indices did you trade? But more importantly, I think an issue looking forward is that it seems as though, and not just seems, but in fact, you have eliminated those positions. Towards the end of 2020, you were no longer in them. Instead, what you did was make an unadulterated bet on raw materials, including gold, or prioritizing gold, stating that they represent a less conditional and more straightforward case than stock prices in a negative interest rate scenario. What goes on there? Stocks offer earnings, dividends, and growth. Raw materials don't. You could argue that with negative interest rates and fiscal stimulus that we've never been in an environment which is so propitious for stocks. Can you elaborate on some of this, please?
Right. Okay, so let me start with the first question, which is what index? And then most of the time, the index that we used was we switched around. But the most of the time of the index that we used was the NASDAQ futures, right? The NASDAQ futures with a heavy weight on high-tech stocks. We did switch, I would say that maybe another 25% may have been S&P at times, and maybe 25% or maybe a little less Russell. So we switched around indices as we saw fit. There was a moment in which we thought that there would be some good rotation, so we went out of NASDAQ and S&P into Russell. So that tells you what we did, and actually it worked out well. Towards the end of the third quarter, we eliminated those positions, but in the fourth quarter itself, we did have exposure to Russell futures, not for long, for a week, maybe for 10 days, and I started to lose some interest in it. Because the story was getting a little bit worn. So now I'll come back to that issue. When you have negative interest rates, you have investors looking for opportunities somewhere. They have to invest their money somewhere. And stocks is an excellent place to put the money in. And so is, in some ways, so is land, and so is commodity prices. Almost anything is better than negative interest rates. Now, there's a shift that goes on between the various assets. And what we're saying is, I think we use the word less conditional and more straightforward. I think that's what we used when we justify our shift to commodities, in that stock prices are affected by a whole number of things. For example, tax policy. The incoming administration has a tax policy that is different than the previous one. Chances are that they will raise corporate taxes. So that's going to eat substantially into earnings per share. It also will be more interested in regulating or re-regulating business. And so that means that it's going to be a little harder for corporations to make money. And finally, at some point, we're going to see labor costs increase a little faster than they've been increasing till now. And so profit margins will begin to narrow. So all around, we can make a case that even though stock prices generally are good, and generally are asset to own during periods of negative interest rates and even during periods of very low rates, low real rates. But there may be better opportunities somewhere else. And that was the point that we're making, that commodities, raw materials, gold are not bought for investment. They're not bought for income. But on the other hand, they are hard assets. And it's a place that very often people will run to be able to protect themselves from the ravages of what you call negative rates, which is negative returns. And we experienced something like that in an extreme way in the 70s when rates were negative for a long period of time, and we had a lot of inflation, and commodity prices did very well during the period. I'm not saying that this experience will be the same. No two experiences are the same, but like they say, it's not identical, but it rhymes. So you do have the possibility here that commodity prices will do well. There's another reason why commodity prices may do well, and I think I wrote about it, and that is there are supply constraints that have developed over the last couple of years. The commodities and the industry. So that means the supply is growing at a smaller pace than it needs to grow. So you have ideal conditions now for commodity prices to go up. As it is, commodity prices have already recovered well from the lows. They're about 75-80% from the lows, March low. But that's just the beginning, just a recovery. That's just a recovery. We think that we're now in for a fairly long rise in prices. Not all commodities will do well. That's why we use baskets of commodities. All right. So that, I guess, should answer the question.
Yeah, it does. It leads, I think, readily to the size of the gold position. In the asset allocation fund, I've asked you why you have such a large position, and for those who are not invested in the asset allocation fund, I'll just say that it's in general about a third in gold, about a third in gold miners, and about a third in home builders. So that's the same amount. Two-thirds of the fund's assets are at risk to the appreciation or the depreciation of gold. Gold, you've said when we spoke about this, you consider to be a material and will do as well and probably better than commodity prices. Is that because you are really making more of an inflation bet than you're acknowledging, or what's the thinking there?
No, I think your suggestion, I mean your idea, I think is reasonable. I think what I wrote was that gold is a hybrid. Gold is half gold, half commodity, half money. So it reacts to commodity prices going up, and it always does. If commodity prices go up, it will go up with it. But there is some element of money. And I gave an example, for example, and it's not a typical example, but it could be the kind of example that is paradigmatic of the years to come. Russia's international reserves today have more gold than dollars, than any currency in their portfolio. I think they have about a 23-25% exposure to gold, maybe a 22-23% exposure to dollars, and then other currencies. So what I'm saying is that is the monetary element, and what may be the case that other countries, especially countries that have an adversarial relationship with the U.S., such as China, may want to own more gold than U.S. dollar treasuries. So there is a money side, a money element involved. And I think that together with the commodity element makes gold an ideal investment. By the way, last year, I think that gold went up maybe just as much as the S&P, a little bit more than the S&P, in fact. I think it went up a little bit more than the S&P, but I don't quote me. I think it did. Yeah, I think it did. So it's sort of a combination of commodity and money, and you know, also there's another thing about gold, which is strange, but is that it is very difficult today to bring into production gold. We can't find deposits. It takes a tremendous amount of money to find gold deposits. And when you do find them, it takes many, many years to exploit them. Governments have become very strict with environmental rules and other rules, labor rules. So the supply of gold, the actual supply of gold, has not kept pace with its long-term growth. So we're coming into a situation where the supply of gold is maybe flat production. So if it's flat and you have a lot of money in the system and money is growing in the system, you should be able to see gold prices go up. You know, it's not necessarily a given that you know, there's a tremendous advantage in equities that their businesses, if they're well run, they make money, they grow every year, year after year, they pay dividends. So there's a tremendous advantage in owning assets as equities. And I'm not arguing that one should be only in gold and only in commodities, but I think one can have some judicious mix of commodities and stocks. But it is a more complicated animal, and especially in an administration that has already said that they will be raising taxes, and so after-tax earnings will be considerably lower in the coming years.
To what extent are you, how should I put it? To what extent is the, apart from, you talked about moneyness and you talked about gold as a commodity, but what about gold as or what you haven't talked about is gold as the beneficiary of the perverse beneficiary of inflation. In the past, you've spoken about inflation primarily from a monetary perspective, noting that the monetary aggregates, whether you look at them conventionally or using the Devisia method, which you've at times subscribed to, have grown in a way that would have Milton Friedman turning over in his grave. May he rest in peace. May he rest in peace.
I would never have thought you would say that. Okay, go ahead.
What do you think? Right. What do you think is going to happen there? Do you think that we are going to see inflation? Is that?
I think so. I think so. I think that that's the secret bet. I think that you're going to see an outburst of inflation. You know, it's a funny thing. It's very difficult to measure inflation well. For example, in the 70s, you measured inflation mostly by consumer prices. In this generation, you may be measuring inflation by land prices, house prices, paintings, assets in general. So I don't know. One can actually say that there's been inflation, and inflation is substantial, but it's harder to... David, are you still there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. David? Yeah. Okay. It's harder to measure it. So we have difficulties in measuring it. And of course, we have another difficulty measuring, which is people replace their basket of goods and they go for the cheaper goods. And so the consumer price basket is constantly being depressed or deflated. So it doesn't give you a proper picture. You know, people are not flying. You know, airline tickets have gone down 75%, but people are not flying. So the basket doesn't include, a basket that includes airlines, for example, or airline tickets, will not be giving you a proper reading of inflation because people are not flying. So this is a problem with measuring inflation. But I do think that you're going to see, even with all that, you're going to see higher rates. And I would not be surprised to see rates of 3% and 4% and maybe higher. It depends how long we keep this monetary policy like the way it is now. The other thing that's interesting is that there may be a willingness on the part of the authorities to see that. I mean, we have seen now some pronouncements by the Federal Reserve that they will be very liberal in their thinking about inflation. They would not be at all surprised and even would welcome a pickup in inflation because they feel that inflation has been underperforming for the past few years. So they don't mind if it overperforms in the next few years. But the deep down, the real reason why governments like inflation is because it eats into the debt, into the national debt. It eats into the real value of the national debt. It's the easiest way out of the big burden of debt. It's probably impossible for the governments to ever grow themselves out of the debt by taxing. You're not going to see governments tax everybody 80% or something like that to pay back the debt. So the easiest way of doing it is what happened after World War II, which is you engineer some higher than expected inflation, and then the real value of the debt goes down, and you bring it back to normal. So it's not only something that can happen, we believe it will happen, but it's also something that we think authorities want it to happen. Right? They're happy to see inflation going up.
Right.
You know, the question is up to what point? So, you know, maybe they will allow 3% on a sustained basis for 6 months. But what if it gets to 4? Well, maybe at 4, they will start thinking that they have to raise rates. But at any rate, we do have the connivance of authorities when it comes to inflation. I think they'll breathe with some, there'll be a sigh of relief when they see inflation numbers above the classic, the proverbial 2% per annum.
Yeah, and I think also I don't see why people would be skeptical about this. One of the great cliches in finance is don't fight the Fed. The Fed has been very clear. They say they want inflation at 2%. Why would we think that they wouldn't be able to generate it?
They should be able to generate. I mean, in Japan, they were not able to generate inflation, but that's for another reason, technical reason. They never were able to raise the rate of growth of money. If you look at the rate of growth of broad money aggregates and even narrow ones, money supply in Japan never grew very fast. So it never did accomplish, it never did do what they wanted it to do, but even with very low rates. But I think the U.S., they can do it. And I think it's possible, and I think we will see higher rates of inflation, and it will be accepted by the Fed. It will be accepted and even welcome.
Before we leave gold completely, do you think the $64,000 question, or shall we say, the three Bitcoin question, is Bitcoin eating into the appetite for gold?
It may be eating at the margin, the little guys, the little traders who are enamored by it. But as you know, there's been some real suspicion that there's a lot of manipulation in this market. The latest one, and I think we will find out very soon, and probably that's why the market is already falling, is that the Bitcoin market is being powered by another crypto called Tether. And this Tether is a creation out of thin air, which some fraudsters have created, and they tell you that it's backed by a dollar, but we'll find out it's not backed by a dollar. So many exchanges who do not have access to banks will accept Tethers and will allow you to buy Bitcoin with Tethers or Tethers, I don't know how you call it. And they even give you leverage. So there's a lot of things going on there that are not very, let's call it kosher. So I think that Bitcoin will wipe out a lot of the little guys who went into this market in recent months. And then start all over again. It's not an attack itself on Bitcoin. It's an attack on that dark corner of the world. The cryptocurrency corner is a dark corner. It's a corner that where money launderers and cheats and all kinds of people practice, and including these people who create money out of thin air. So it does not mean that Bitcoin itself is the problem, but I think you will see it fluctuate from time to time in a big way, go down 50% or 60% or 70%, go up 50%, 60%, 70%. I don't think it will be something that will attract serious money. So, yes, the little guy, I think, that has been buying it, I also think that the little guy has been selling gold, if he had any gold, and he's been buying some of these. But I don't see a central bank buying Bitcoin instead of buying gold. And I don't see a major financial institution buying Bitcoin instead of buying gold. You know, so it's not a threat from the serious players, but it is a threat at the margin. And maybe this is the reason why gold has been sort of very quiet and very stable in the past few months without making any headway, because we've had some air leaking out of the bubble or some air leaking out of the balloon.
Do you think that the retail investor, the famously bored millennial who's on the Robinhood website, has a significant influence in asset prices today?
Yeah, it amplifies the movement, no question. I think that it will end up having no effect, meaning it will not have any effect on the way down too. I think that it will cause a lot of the selling that will take place will take place because of these people liquidating positions. But so it has an effect in amplifying the movement. It does not have an effect in a long term basis, because these people, these traders are very quick traders. They're not investors. So it won't have an impact. It won't have an impact on long-term asset values. But you will see huge fluctuations. And this used to happen in the States in the 50s and 60s when we had an exchange called the CURB. The American Stock Exchange was the little sister of the New York Stock Exchange. And it carried mostly below $5 stocks. And, you know, there were a lot of below $5 stocks. It was called the CURB. And that was a place where speculation, every 4 or 5 years, or 6 years, whenever speculation heated up, you had the little guys run up these stocks fivefold, tenfold. It was a party. It was a huge party. Well, in those days, they didn't have a Robin Hood, but it was the same party, right? And I think that we're repeating the same thing as we did 60 years ago, 70 years ago.
Okay, speaking about a youthful sector and a very quick decision, you stepped into cannabis stocks, in the words of one of our investors, almost without prior warning and discussion. That's not your style, he says. What's the story in brief?
Right. It's true. I was overcome by temptation. It's true.
Temptation for what?
Temptation for something else than our mainstay positions. But what I was doing was playing, it was a concept. And it's the slow legalization of cannabis in the U.S. And New Jersey now has legalized, and that's huge, huge market. Some of those companies that we have exposure to New Jersey, people coming from other states. It will become more and more legalized. And at some point, the whole country will be legalized. And not only will that do a lot for the prices of stocks, but think of this. These stocks are Canadian stocks, but they're American companies. They're American companies listed in Canada. And they cannot be listed in the U.S. because of the federal ban on cannabis. Now, think of this. Once it gets legalized, these stocks can now go on NASDAQ, right? So you just imagine the kind of potential demand that you're going to get from investors who want to play the legalization, right, in the U.S., in NASDAQ. They don't go buy stocks in the Canadian exchange. Nobody knows about the Canadian exchange. We bought them in the Canadian exchange, and we had to be very careful how we bought them. We took 3 weeks for us to buy the position. But you're going to see people buying on NASDAQ at much higher prices, and I think that's when we're going to sell. So it's more like a concept than anything else. It's a bit of a concept. It's very similar, I would say, to what happened with gambling, the legalization of gambling. It was a slow legalization, but it spread and it spread, and you had incredible movers. Resource International, I remember, went up enormously. There were many stocks that went up a lot when legalization spread. And I'm sort of counting on that type of phenomenon to take place. So it's conceptual, psychological. Don't pin me down more than that. I cannot really tell you that this is great values, although I have to say that these companies do earn some money. you know, so they do earn some money. They're not like the Canadian companies that we know that didn't earn any money and went up and down. These companies do earn money, and I think they're going to be good targets for speculative buying once it gets into the U.S. market.
Let's turn quickly to, or briefly to, a more conventional sector, home builders. It's been the story for one of your stories for a very long time now, maybe one of the longest held stories that that you've had. The story was the story's gone through many phases. It's been a dormant story in the sense of its results. Last year, it had a nice push. Now it's facing it's basically a non-consensus view. There are those who say that we're in the beginnings, or you're still the early innings of a housing boom. There are those who say that already the market is pricing itself out of potential buyers. Where do you stand now? We haven't talked about the 10-year rate. The 10-year rate
Sorry, I'm as excited as I was 5 years ago and 6 years ago. I didn't remember. It was for sure after I was 10 years old, but I put it on a long time ago. and the story was simple. After 2008, after the big crash, very few homes were built. So 2008, 2009, 2011, 2010, 11, 12, you actually, the building built less homes than the long-term demand curve, right? Much less than long-term. But every year, the story got better, because every year the gap got wider, right? The gap gets wider as they build less and less, and as people need more and more. Demographics makes it that people want more homes. Now, here came two extraordinary events that now are taking these things up and are going to do very well, which is, number one, the fact that mortgage rates, as you just mentioned, are now at 2.6, 2.7%, 30-year mortgage rates. Compare that to the fact that home prices are going up by 5, 6, 7% a year. So you'd be crazy not to buy a home and finance it with a mortgage if you can. It's a perfect trade. It's a perfect investment. You're financing a long-term asset that has upside with very cheap money. That's one thing. The second thing is that suddenly became something that people wanted to own in this pandemic, and they wanted to move out of the cities, of the core of the cities, and they wanted to go to a nice home outside in suburbs or even further out. So now you had two factors that were pushing this thing, and I had to get back on. So where was I? It was saying that we, on the basis of sales, we're down to the lowest level of inventories in history, less than 2 months of sales, worth of sales, that's inventory. And as to the argument that prices going up deter buyers, yes, they do. But for now, we don't see any such sign, right? Because we still see sales going up and prices going up. So obviously, the buyers are still willing to buy. So we haven't seen any resistance. My feeling is that we will see builders ramp up their production of houses, of homes, and they will ramp them up to above their long-term trend for some time. And then you'll start seeing a weakening price structure. Either prices stop going up or they begin to come off a little bit. That will be the top of the market. So we have a long way to go. And I think that what happened is the market now is firm despite a lot of naysayers. And in the last couple of days, the numbers, the sales and the housing starts and the sentiment has been superb. And I think that you see them, some of them are making today's new highs. Some of these home builds are making new 12-month highs. And that's a good sign. That's a very good sign.
Good. Well, I hope that works out. I'm sure you do too. We're down to our last question, and it comes from an employee an anonymous employee who puts the
wait till I find out about him. Okay, yeah.
Yes, wait till we find out about him. He says the pie chart in the most recent quarterly report shows that you'd put on equity put option spreads during the last quarter of the year that you called hedges. But at other times in the office and elsewhere, I think you've written explicitly that you don't believe in hedges. You don't apply hedges. Hedges are not us. What's the deal there?
Right. So it is an unfortunate use of the word. We don't. Well, let me say two things. We don't believe in hedges. I believe that we either want to be long real assets or don't want to be long real assets. We just have to choose which real asset we want to be long. But if we're long, being long real assets is derived from the fact that we have negative interest rates or very low real rates. So we want to be long real assets in that case, and then we have to choose what we want. We should not really have a position in any of the assets and hedge it. It doesn't work out. It never works out well. And we have had much experience that it doesn't work out well. So that's why we have shunned hedging in the past couple of years. And the truth is that the classic form of hedging was at the time taking offsetting positions. So you could be long some index in the U.S. and short some index in Brazil or India or something like that. And that was like sort of like a very classic kind of a hedge because you were betting on one against the other. Over time, we discarded that. And assumed that all these are separate, independent trades. But we did keep in our pocket the idea that if we were caught in a position suddenly, out of nowhere, was caught in a position that was very hard to liquidate, and it's a long position, and it's not easy to liquidate because maybe prices were not so liquid. Maybe stocks were not so liquid. Usually it's in stocks. We might use hedges by doing options. Because in options, we have just a limited loss possibility, right? We're not going to go short something else, but we could buy some options. But other than that, for example, now, we have nothing to hedge. Our positions were long commodities, long gold, and long home builders. That's basically our position. And we didn't think that we want to be hedged in any of them. We in fact think that the market could be subject to a sharp correction. And it's not impossible that home builders will correct along with the market. We think it will do well relative to the market, it will do better than the market, but we don't feel that we need to hedge. Right? So it's not as, so the using that terminology was not good. It should have been more like it is a put spread, because we felt that the conditions are such that the market could have a severe setback in the first quarter of the year because it looked very, very crowded. Right. So what we did is instead of buying puts outright, which given volatility, very high volatility, we didn't want to spend so much money, we decided, you know what, let's buy spreads that will make us money if the market drops 5%, 6%, 8%, up to 10%. We're looking for a big move, just that amount. And it wasn't a hedge. It was simply an interesting trade. It's not turning out well. You know, we bought them at the end of December. Some of them are expiring in 2 weeks. Some of them are expiring in 6 weeks. And they're not turning out well, but we didn't spend a lot of money. Maybe we spent 1% and 1/4 of the net assets. But let nobody think that it's a hedge, because we're not hedging anything.
Al, thank you. That's it. We've done our duty. We've responded to all the questions put to us. Unless you have something that you want to conclude with, I thank you for your time, and I'll thank those of you who are going to listen to this podcast for your time, and wish you well for the coming quarter, and look forward to speaking to you then.
Okay, good, David. Very good. I just want to tell our shareholders that we are very, very confident that we will have a very, very good quarter and year. I can't say quarter exactly, but quarter and year. Certainly a very good year. Should things work, should our scenario work out, I think we're going to have an excellent year. That's it.
Super. Good luck. Okay. I hope that you're
great.
Right. Thank you.
Great. Okay, David. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.